October 17, 2012, in Vrindavan, India, Nectar Devotion, Chapter 5.
All right, I just want to let you know that for tomorrow, you do not need to have any come to class with any questions on Chapter 6, because there's not logically any questions you could ask. It's just a list. Chapter 6 is just a list. And then in the chapters that follow Chapter 6, there's discussion of everything on the list. So, just to give you a little, you should have this in your book, where Chapter 7 through Chapter 12 is just a discussion of everything on the list in Chapter 6. So tomorrow it's going to be mostly an interactive activity class. There's not that much to discuss because it's, as I say, it's just a list. And all the explanations come afterwards. So today we're looking at Chapter 5. And this, the way that Rupa Goswami has organized the Bhaktivedanta Sindhu reminds me to some extent of how he organized the Upadesha Amrita in texts 5 and 6. So you remember in the Upadesha Amrita, in the Nectar of Instruction, text 5, he listed the three kinds of devotees and how to deal with them. You all remember that? And then in text 6, he said how not to distinguish. Well, text 6, he said, don't distinguish based on the body. You all remember that? From Upadesha Amrita? So something very similar is happening here, where Rupa Goswami has been telling us what are the qualifications to take up Uttama Bhakti. The first thing he said is you need to have what?
Attraction.
Some sort of taste, some sort of attraction, some kind of interest. But then to actually start Vaidhi Bhakti, you need two things. What do you need? Faith and
knowledge.
Faith and knowledge to take up Vaidhi Bhakti. Now, he's going to say what you don't need. What do you not need to take up Bhakti? Basically, the three things you don't need: you don't need a pious birth, you don't need to have prior purifications through rituals, and you don't need to have executed Varnashram Dharma. You don't need any of those three things. So I wanted to start off this class. Actually, before we do that, just, it wasn't my intention, I guess it was the intention of God, but it wasn't my intention that you would each get a copy of this, but you each have a copy of this now. So somebody was asking me yesterday in the written questions, where did I get that statement about being not experiencing the miseries of life? Remember, we were talking about the characteristics of pure devotional service, and the first one is Kleshakni, gets rid of your miseries. And we were talking about how it gets rid of the miseries of Parabdha Karma. In other words, the miseries we're experiencing right now. And I gave two ways that bhakti has that effect. One is through you have a transcendent equipoise mentality. And the other is that you see your situation as part of Krishna's adventure. And someone was saying, where did you get that from? So we printed this out. This is from Jiva Dharma, which is by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, part 4. And I'll just read through this because I think it's very extraordinary. The leelas of Sri Krishna are unlimited and variegated. Hence, this material world also is another of his many unique activities. When the supreme autocrat willfully engages in a kaleidoscope of pastimes, do you all know what a kaleidoscope is? It's a toy that children have that has little colors in it and little mirrors, and you turn it and it makes different designs. Why should it be unusual for him to enact this particular pastime? So this, by this, Bhaktivinoda Thakura means the material world. If the principle of variegated leelas is kept intact, not a single type of leela can be rejected. So he's saying we also have to accept that the Lord's creation and maintenance of this world is another kind of leela. Whatever the lila, the participants assisting the Lord may have to accept many hardships and pain. So he's talking about externally. You know, if you're in Krishna's lila and Gokula Vrindavan and Indra floods Vrindavan, and demons come, I mean actual demons, huge monsters as big as buildings. Sri Krishna is the Purusha, the supreme enjoyer and absolute master. All the Upakarana, participants in paraphernalia, are fully under the control of the Purusha, and they are the working tools of the supreme creator. In fully surrendering oneself to the sweet will of the supreme Lord, it is only natural that one may have to accept adversities also. If finally this material adversity turns into an auspicious state that is far from miserable, then why ultimately should one call it adversity? On the transcendental platform, the tribulations of the jiva, while trying to satisfy the Lord his pastimes, are by all accounts pleasurable. Yet the conditioned soul, here Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, see the material world as Krishna's pastime. Become Krishna's instrument in that pastime. And see your tribulations and difficulties as simply part of Krishna's pastimes. He says, on the transcendental platform, the tribulations of the jiva while trying to satisfy the Lord in his pastimes are by all accounts pleasurable. So then you will experience your so-called tribulations as pleasurable. Yet the conditioned soul, by misuse of his free will, denies himself the exaltation one experiences whilst directly assisting Sri Krishna in his transcendental pastimes. So here Bhaktivinoda Thakur is saying, it's simply a misuse of our will that we're experiencing our miseries as miseries instead of experiencing them as blissful parts of Krishna's pastimes. Exaltation is a joyful celebration. Instead, he embraces Maya, who gives him only acute harassment. If anyone is to blame for this dilemma, it is the jiva and definitely not Krishna. So it's quite an extraordinary way of looking at our tribulations. So I thought that for this chapter, I would turn again to the presentation that I have on Bhagavad Gita chapter 12. Because things such as pious birth, auspicious activities and varnashram are very, very much part of the systems of yoga other than bhakti. And this point, I think, is important enough that I wanted to go through it, and I thought, since I have this presentation on chapter 12, we can go through this, and you can also, therefore, see the relationship between chapter 12 of the Bhagavad Gita and this part of the Nectar of Devotion. Now, some of this we went through before, and that I'll go through quickly. But I'm going to go through the parts of this presentation I did before again so you can see it all together. Okay, so here's the ultimate goal that we want to. I guess I can't do that. Okay. So here, Arjuna's question in the beginning of chapter 12 is, should I take up bhakti from the beginning, or should I first realize the self and Brahman, and then from that point I'll be purified, and then I can take up bhakti? So this is the point that Rupa Goswami is also, and Srila Prabhupada is dealing with in chapter 5. You don't need to first be pure to take up bhakti. This misconception exists in our Hare Krishna movement. This misconception exists in our Hare Krishna movement. That first you have to become purified and then you can take up bhakti. But this concept does not have to do with bhakti, it has to do with other kinds of yoga. Okay, so we're going to look at taking up bhakti from the beginning. So what is the process? Maya Shakta Mano, that your mind's fixed on Shyamasundara with transcendental faith. I wonder if I can have this work. Would that work? Then I can have the mic on each of my machine. Okay. Good. I just can't see it. Sorry, I'm trying to adjust the technologies. This technology, that technology. I'm going to ask you to bear with me just for 1 second here. For Krishna. And a little later on in the Nectar Devotion, Srila Prabhupada is going to make some very extraordinary comments on this point. This is one of my favorite purports, where Prabhupada says that the devotee sometimes hears or reads books or goes to the marketplace and is always in samadhi. I think we talked about this before, the difference between mechanical samadhi and loving samadhi. How when you're always loving someone, you're actually always thinking of them. The nature of this path is very easy. It's very natural, just like worship of the deity. And even though there's some difficulty for the devotees in controlling their senses, still they're so attracted to Krishna that they're not really experiencing the difficulty that the person must go through. And how do they get delivered? Krishna personally does it. Krishna personally comes and gets the devotee. Even if the devotee hasn't perfectly executed yin and karma. Without worrying about the path of light, the path of darkness, what's the correct rituals, anything mechanical, Krishna delivers the devotee coming on the back of Guruji. And no previous qualification. You don't need to have attained Brahma Bhuta first before you can start the path of bhakti. Bhakti itself will bring you to the Brahma Bhuta platform. Okay, now let's come. Yes. And my computer isn't even plugged in. It's getting from there. Okay, now we're going to contrast this with the yoga letter. What?
No, I just asked what happened. So I
got a shock from my Okay, now, this is important that we're making this contrast. Why is Rupa Goswami bringing up this point? You don't need pious birth, you don't need purification, you don't need varnashram. Because people are going to think that you do. Why are they going to think that you do? Because in the other systems of yoga, you do need these. So let's see what it's like in the other systems of yoga. So Krishna says, at last they achieve me. So who is this me? So Prabhupada says this me is Vasudeva Krishna. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says it's Brahman. And Baladeva Dibhushan says it's someone like Narayana. This is not so important. Arjuna is asking, this controversy is Arjuna asking, first you realize the self or first you realize Brahman. And
that's the question.
If it's really quick.
Yeah, I'm looking at it. Krishna says his name being Krishna.
I don't want to go there now. Sorry. So this, you could also say it's both. The point is that in the other systems of yoga, you first have to have full self-realization and realization of Brahman, and then you can progress to bhakti. Okay, what is the description of what you realize? Something beyond the senses, unmanifested, indefinite, all-pervading, inconceivable, immovable, fixed. Now, why would someone want to do this? Why would they say, well, first I want to become purified, and then I want to engage in bhakti?
Like, you need some kind of qualification. If you want to be a doctor, you have to take an education first, right? Sorry.
Yes, something like that. They're also thinking it'd be easier. The thing would be easier. They're thinking bhakti will be much easier if I'm purified first. That's how they're thinking. Now, of course, a lot of people on this other yoga path don't even feel that they're going to bhakti. They feel they're going to something else. They may decide they want bhakti later. This stuff is being preached in ISKCON right now.
Really?
Yes. Yes. As we are sitting in this room, there are people who are writing papers saying that everybody first has to become expert in varnashram and has to have the right body and the right birth, and then they can take up bhakti. And they are presenting these papers to the GBC. Now, right now, as we're sitting in this room. This is not a theoretical discussion. This is not a chapter in Nectar Devotion or in Bhagavad Gita that, oh yeah, we know that. This is a controversy going on even at very high levels in our movement. I'm just simply telling you. I'm not emphasizing this because it's just something theoretical. Oh yeah, everybody knows that. Why is Rumi Lee even talking about this? Why is Rupa Goswami talking about this? Yeah, we know this. We don't all know this. And there are many devotees who think they're doing bhakti yoga. They're not. They're doing something else. Because they don't really understand the nature of bhakti. Okay, so here Baladev Vijayabhushan is saying that they think if they first realize the self, then their bhakti will be without obstacles. And here's a place where Prabhupada's saying that self-realization is preliminary. But you'll notice that Srila Prabhupada's talking about it rather as a stage of bhakti rather than as something separate from bhakti. Now the process of the yoga ladder involves worship, controlling the senses, seeing everyone equally, and working for everyone's welfare. I'm going through this quickly. Normally this particular presentation is a 3-hour presentation. But I thought since I had it and it was related, we could go through it quickly. Now, to attain perfection on this path is very troublesome and difficult, and it's very theoretical. It's not practical. Remember, we were saying how bhakti is practical. You can engage in worship with the deity immediately. It's difficult. Vishnachakravarti Thakur says it's like trying to stop a river. Arjuna talked about this too. Chanchalahi Manakrishna. It's like trying to stop the mind. It also needs worship. You can't even do this other path without worship of Krishna. So there has to be even some mixture of bhakti even on this other path. You're trying to realize something that's against the nature of the self. There's a danger of turning to atheism. And the main important thing for today, it needs prior qualification. So here Prabhupada says, those who have been able to eradicate their sins by living according to the dictates of their social and spiritual order and who have thus acquired sufficient piety are qualified to practice karma yoga. Gradually they progress to jnana yoga and finally in meditation, that's jnana yoga, they realize the transcendental and supreme position of the Lord. And how do they get to bhakti? They have to have the grace of the devotee. Didn't we talk about that at the beginning of bhakti? So you were saying these other processes, they go up and up with so many qualifications, then they need the grace of a devotee to come to bhakti. Whereas those starting bhakti, they're getting the grace of a devotee in the beginning. Okay, now some of this we went through already. Right, remember we talked about this? What is bhakti? To fix your mind on Krishna, fix your intelligence on Krishna, in the path of Radha Mula Bhakti. So this is just a review. If you're not qualified for Radha Mula Bhakti, you practice in Abhyas Yoga or Sadhana Bhakti by repeatedly pulling your mind back to Krishna, which is on the transcendental platform. The beginning of sadhana bhakti, again, is to find a way to fix your mind on Krishna and to revive the natural love for Krishna. And here Prabhupada talks about the externals. And while doing those externals, we always think about Krishna, engaging the gross body in all kinds of acts of service to the Lord, and the subtle mind in thinking about Krishna. With the mood, and this will be discussed later on also in the name of devotion, with the mood that Krishna is taking care of my material life. Which doesn't mean you don't work, but it means you work in the mood that Krishna is maintaining you. How do you get there? How do you get to Sadhana Bhakti? Alright, now this is from Sadhana Bhakti to Radha Yuga by desire. If you can't practice Sadhana Bhakti, then you work for Krishna. You do the Amrita of Bhakti even without thinking of Krishna. Without a mood of going to heaven or liberation. How do you get to Vyasa Yoga or Sadhana Bhakti? Through developing peace. Everybody remembers this? Okay. And we talked about how to achieve peace by seeing Krishna as our boss. That everything we do for Him, always trying to please Krishna. The Lord is the proprietor. Not working for results, giving everything to Krishna in the now. And this is where we ended last time. Engaging the senses in bhakti, then learning how to bring back the mind, then full absorption of the mind. Alright, now we're going to describe the other path. You see the difference here. Here, instead of going through the angas of bhakti, if one goes through the yoga ladder, you have to start with varnashram. You have to start with pious work. From pious work, you can go from doing that same work for purification, then you go to knowledge of the self, then meditation on the self, then achieving realization of the self. It's quite a different path. Okay, the indirect path is first you have to engage in vyashram, in your social and spiritual order. You've got to get piety. You've got to be purified. You've got to have many, many births of going through the varnashram system till you come to that of being a brahmana. Then you can take that same varnashram system, and you are doing it now for purification instead of for heaven. Your motive changes. Instead of heaven, for purification. That's karma yoga. By working in that way, you attain peace. From peace, you can progress to Gyan Yoga. From Gyan Yoga, you're able to control the mind enough to meditate, and then you can see Shyam Sundar. Okay, so first thing they have to do is they have to first engage in Varnashram Dharma and become pious. It's the first thing a person on this path has to do. That's before they can even start the yoga ladder. This is before you can even start, you have to engage in Varnashram. Then take step one, where you're doing the same work, but you're doing it for purification instead of heaven. So you're doing Varnashram duties, but detached. Karma palatyaga, you're giving up the fruits of your work. The fruit is heaven. You're giving up the fruits. And offering all actions to Krishna with a controlled mind. Then, one is studying the Upanishads to gain knowledge of the self. Then one can understand the Supreme Controller. Now, because Krishna says the purpose of Sankhya and Karma is the same, you can go from Varnashram directly to Gyan Yoga. So you can go from Varnashram to Karma Yoga or from Varnashram to Gyan Yoga. Then how does the person go from Karma Yoga or Gyan Yoga to Dhyan Yoga or meditation? Right? What do all these things do? They subdue the mind. They subdue the mind. So Karma Yoga subdues the mind and Gyan Yoga subdues the mind. Wow, you attain peace. Remember, peace was the requirement for sadhana bhakti. Krishna says, Tvagat Jantir Anantaram. At the end of giving up the fruits of your work, you attain peace. So the result of Karma Yoga or Gyan Yoga is peace. When we let go of our attachments, we get peace. So when you work for purification, instead of absorbing, you become peaceful. When you're not trying to satisfy your desires. And Krishna says you can't have happiness without peace. Oops. Then step three, after you have finished karma yoga or jnana yoga, then you can go to jnana yoga. You can actually meditate, because now you're peaceful. Your mind's not disturbed. You can meditate on the Lord. Now, how do you go from karma yoga, jnana yoga, jnana yoga, to the abhyasa yoga, bhakti? I want you to note very carefully, you cannot go from karma yoga, jnana yoga, or jnana yoga to raga yoga, bhakti, directly. You have to go to Sadhana. How does that happen? By the grace of some devotee. What do you need? Interesting. You need faith. What has all that karma yoga and jnana yoga and jnana yoga brought you? Faith and the grace of a devotee. So you know what? If you already have faith and the grace of a devotee, do you need to go through the karma yoga, jnana yoga, and jnana yoga? No. That's what you're doing it for. You're going through the karma, you're going through the varnashram, karma yoga, jnana yoga, jnana yoga, to get what? To get peace, to get faith, and you need the grace of a devotee. So here's the handout that you have. So this is the general yoga ladder. First, people are engaged in ubha karma, vikarma. Then they go to karma kanda or varnashram. From there they can go to karma yoga or they can go directly to jnana yoga, then to jnana yoga. But you see, you can come to the angas of bhakti. You can come to the angas of bhakti from either vikarma or karma. You don't have to go up the other path. Even from vikarma, you can go directly to the angas of bhakti, which will give you the peace to go to abhyasa yoga or full sadhana bhakti, which will give you the desire to go to raga yoga bhakti. Now here we see the position of varnashram. So the angas of bhakti can include optional varnashram as what's called vana dharma, or a subsidiary function. But they're not required for previous purification, and they're not required for faith. So these are the two paths to abhyasa yoga, the angas of bhakti, which are direct, which directly give you peace, the yoga ladder, which gives you peace and faith. And there are also some mixtures, okay? So, one is the long road. From the beginning of karma yoga to the end of bhakti yoga is a long way to self-realization. So first there's karma yoga. What increases in knowledge and renunciation, it's jnana yoga. What increases in meditation, then it's called astanga yoga or jnana yoga. Then finally you come to bhakti. That's the long road. Then you have the elevator or the lift. So we can go to the top quickly. It's a direct process. So we can go step by step, or we can go directly in an elevator. Okay. Turn off the projector. See now why the devotee, if you have the grace of a devotee and you already have faith, you don't need to go through all those processes. What is their purpose? What's the purpose of varnashram?
Liberation.
Liberation? No, pranasha? Indirectly.
It's a stepping stone for liberation.
It's a stepping stone for what?
For bhakti.
No, it's not a stepping stone for bhakti.
Permission for the soul to perform the devotional service.
No, it's not.
Cooperation for the spiritual development.
For having this life and experience. Follow something at least. Follow something at least. Something
for the function of something like varnashram is we come to this world to satisfy our senses. So varnashram is giving you, here's a scriptural way that you can satisfy your senses in accord with the scripture. And by doing so, you amass some pious activities that purifies your mind somewhat. And you come to the conclusion that, wait a minute, all this trying to satisfy my senses isn't working very well. All this trying to find heaven in this world and in the next world, it's not very effective. And then you become interested either in karma yoga, where you're doing the same, you're doing your varnashram work, but you're doing it for purification. Or you become interested in gyan yoga, where let me study about the supreme. Let me study about transcendence. That's its purpose. Its purpose is to awaken some interest in the transcendence, to give you enough contact with the mode of goodness that you become interested in the transcendence. And also allow one to satisfy one's material desires in the material world in a pious way. How to satisfy your material desires in a way that will also awaken transcendence. But if your desire for transcendence awakens, you don't need to do that to awaken your desire for transcendence. It's just not necessary. Why is bhakti an easy and direct path? Because what's the essence of our conditioning is that I don't like Krishna. I'm envious of Krishna. And the simplest, most direct way to reverse that is by learning to like Krishna. That solves the whole problem. You know, the other is much more like if you put a naughty child in the corner and the child is saying, I want to get out of the corner. But they're not trying to learn how to really be good. They just want to get out of the corner. So all these other paths, they're aiming for liberation. They're just aiming for, I don't want to suffer anymore. Instead of, I want to get to the root of why I'm suffering. Remember we talked about that with Klesha Agni and identity. So for some people, they may have to go step by step. But in this age, it's hard to go step by step. First of all, Kama Sudra Sambhava. Everybody's considered to be a Shudra in this age. There's very few people who have really a pious birth. I mean, we may be proud, oh yes, my family's Brahmin for 10 generations, or whatever we're proud of with our birth. And most people are proud of their birth in some way. But most of us don't have pious birth in Kali Yuga. It's very hard to perform varnashram properly in Kali Yuga. So if these things can be awakened without that, then they're not qualification, they're not necessary. So what is the evidence for this? So let's go through this chapter. Srila Prabhupada starts out with saying how there are people, even in the line of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, even in the line of bhakti, following in Mahaprabhu, who say, no, you have to have a certain birth and you have to follow varnashram. I mean, we shouldn't be surprised that this mentality comes into our Hare Krishna movement. And Prabhupada talked about how Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati was fighting against this. You know, he was almost killed. Because he said, no, you don't have to have a certain birth, you don't have to go through varnashram. And Prabhupada took it a step further than Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, because Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati was mostly preaching to Indians in India, but who didn't have birth in Brahmin families. He had a few non-Indian disciples, whereas the vast majority of Srila Prabhupada's disciples were not Indians. So Srila Prabhupada was saying it doesn't matter at all. Not only were the vast majority of Prabhupada's disciples not Indians, but so many of them were not even living pious lives when Srila Prabhupada found them and made them his disciples. And there were many of the people who became Prabhupada's disciples who were living, you know, just taking drugs and so many things. And Prabhupada immediately elevated them. So Srila Prabhupada took this concept to the extreme. But of course, even in Mahaprabhu's day, Haridas Thakur made one prostitute into a devotee. She became such a great devotee, it says, Krishnadas Kaviraj says, that many stalwart Vaishnavas would go to take her darshan. Even though she had been a prostitute. Actually a prostitute. Not only a prostitute, but she had been trying to discredit Haridas Thakur, which is Vaishnava Aparad. Just for money. She wanted to discredit Haridas Thakur. So that was also there, Jagai and Madai becoming devotees, right? Or the Goswamis who had been in the service of the Mohammedans. So that was there. But Srila Prabhupada took that and multiplied that by thousands. The same thing that was done at that time. So Srila Prabhupada was doing it to an extreme extent. And of course, in the beginning of the Hare Krishna movement, there was a lot of criticism from the caste brahmanas and the smartas, and how can these people actually be Vaishnavas? And now we have, now pretty much that's finished. Pretty much Srila Prabhupada's followers are accepted in most places, except for maybe like the Jagannath Puri temple. Few exceptions, but in most places, if you say that you're a member of ISKCON, you're actually following, you can go into the temples that normally only the Hindus can go into. So now the main people propounding this are within our own movement. So we have the people, you know, used to be, Prabhupada was writing these things. When Prabhupada was here in Vrindavan giving lectures on nectar devotion, and he was begging for the local people to accept his disciples as Vaishnavas, and he said, you know, otherwise it's Vaishnava Parad. So he was dealing with people outside of his movement, and the same thing is going on now, but from inside the movement. Oh, we're not pure enough to actually be engaged in sadhana bhakti. First we have to do varnashram, and then we can do sadhana bhakti. And actually writing papers like, the only gurus in ISKCON should be Varnashram Brahmanas. This is the proposal. So saying nobody's actually qualified for sadhana bhakti, we're only qualified for Varnashram. Yes?
What does GBC reply to this letter?
Well, it's not a letter, it's a paper.
Paper.
They're discussing it. So here, but the reason I'm bringing this up is I don't want you to think, oh, this is just something in the book I have to remember for an exam. It seems that this conception, Arjuna had this question 5,000 years ago. Do I first have to become qualified by going through the yoga ladder and then I can take the bhakti? And obviously this is a misconception that continues. And again, I know many devotees who think, well, I can't think about Krishna until I become purified. First I have to become purified in my anarjas, and then I can think of Krishna. Instead of, it's thinking about Krishna that will purify us from our anarjas. First I have to attain the Brahma Bhuta platform, then I can think of Krishna. Thinking of Krishna is what will bring us to the Brahma Bhuta platform. So we're meant to engage in bhakti from the beginning, not that first I do something else and then I do bhakti. And, you know, if you do something else and then try to do bhakti, that something else will be very dry. Karma yogi, yoga, dhyan, they're dry. And if your process is dry, it may be because you're not actually doing bhakti. Yes?
It's sort of both the means and the end.
Yes. Bhakti is the means and the end, exactly. Whereas these other processes, the means and the end are quite different. And the means is dry and difficult and unnatural. So if your practice feels dry and difficult and unnatural, you may not be doing bhakti. You may be doing something else. Like Prabhupada says, if you eat food but you're not satisfied, then either you're not eating real food, like chewing gum. Okay? Everybody knows what is chewing gum? So people, they have something in their mouth, it has some taste, some flavor, and you're moving your jaw, but you're not actually eating anything. So it's either you're not actually in bhakti, or you have parasites. So if you say, I'm eating, but I'm not getting nourished, then either you're not actually eating, you just like chewing gum, or you have parasites. So if one says, I'm in bhakti, but I'm not feeling any satisfaction, either you're not really in bhakti, you're doing something else, thinking it's bhakti, or you're committing offenses that are sucking the life out of the bhakti. Okay, remember when Prabhupada wrote the Nectar Devotion, it was very early in the movement. And he was really having to fight these persons who were saying, oh, your disciples are not actually Vaishnavas. They haven't been born in the right families. They haven't gone through Varnashram. So here, I love this example. I just love this example. From the Padma Purana, everyone has the right to execute devotional service just as he has the right to take early bath in the month of December and January. What a funny example. Why is this example so funny? What's funny about this example? It's cold. Where were they taking bath?
Outside.
Outside, in the river. They were not taking bath. They didn't have a geyser. They didn't have a little heater in the room. You turn on the heater, turn on your geyser, take a nice hot bath inside. No. They were going to the river. Is it cold here in December, January?
Yes.
Who here is? Who has been in Vrindavan in January? It's cold. Imagine walking to the Yamuna in the morning, early in the morning, and going in the Yamuna. Of course, the little gopis did that. Little gopis, like 6, 7 years old, they were doing that. They were going in the, that was the season they were going in. That was after Kartik. It was cold. They were going to the Yamuna early in the morning to take a bath. They didn't stay long in the water. One day when they had to stay long because Krishna took their clothes, they were shivering. It's cold. So when we say everyone can take bath in January, not everybody wants to take a bath early in the morning in January. You see here in Vrindavan, many of the local residents, they don't take bath early in the morning in the winter. You notice that? They're taking bath like 8 or 9 in the morning when they're taking bath. I remember Mahanidhi Swami telling me that. He said a lot of the local people in the winter, they just wash their face, wash their hands, wash their feet, and then they take their bath later after the sun comes up. So everyone has the right to perform bhakti just like everyone has the right to take an early morning bath in the winter. Then this one, the lower caste people who are considered less than shudras are initiating the Vaishnav cult when they're properly dressed with tilak on their bodies and beads in their hands and on their necks. They appear to be coming from Vaikuntha and they surpass the ordinary Brahmin. An example here is given that bell metal can turn into gold by the mixture of mercury.
Wow.
Prabhupada says you have to eat mercury and then urinate on the bell metal. Now, why is this difficult? Because mercury is poisonous. If you eat mercury, you won't be alive to urinate on the bell metal. You'll die first. But that was the alchemy process. That means you had to be a yogi. You had to be a yogi to be able to digest mercury and pass urine on the bell metal and then you could turn it to gold.
Really?
Yeah, really. Prabhupada says it. I turned off my computer already, but it's on the database. You can find it yourself. Because then the devotees were saying, so Prabhupada, we'll do that. And Prabhupada says, yes, first you digest mercury.
But then even like yogis, they take mercury.
They can do that, yeah. No, we can, but those people are not interested in most of them in making gold. They want city, they want other things. And then Prabhupada just makes the note, it's not that initiation is just some formality. Okay, sat in the yajna, got my name, I'm a Brahmin, but actually following the rules and regulations.
This focus is like a, how do you say, like a prophecy?
Maybe.
It was spoken in the past.
Oh, no, it was spoken in the past. So obviously, we're not the first. Obviously, it's happened before.
I mean, maybe it wasn't like a prophecy for a modern day.
I don't think so. I think it happened in the past.
Okay.
So this is the first thing. First thing is good birth. So here we have the evidences. It doesn't need good birth. Once you've gotten Vaishnava Diksha, you're better than a caste Brahmana. That's first. Okay, take a break, 10 minutes.